mountains, deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. From the January 2025 issue of Arizona Highways, this month in history, the lowest temperature ever recorded in Tucson occurred on January 7, 1913. The morning low was 6 degrees at the University of Arizona, where the city's official temperature readings were taken at the time. Colorado River steamboat captain Isaac Pohamas, a longtime Yuma resident, died on January 16, 1922. Pohamas, a New York native, captained the Mojave and other boats during a 50-year career on the river. On January 25, 1906, a moderate earthquake rattled Flagstaff, forcing the closure of the city's schools. The quake was the first of three that occurred in the area over a six-year period. Kathy Montgomery writes about the Bear and Dragon Cafe. The name reflects a British pub tradition, and the decor replicates the feel of an English cottage. The excellent food is an homage to Britannia, too, with menu items named for Charles Dickens, Lancelot, and Queen Victoria. Owning a restaurant wasn't Amanda Adams' dream. She's the author of two fantasy novels, and her first love was literature. Her second, perhaps, was all things English. But decades in food service gave her the background to launch Bear and Dragon Cafe, which has seen phenomenal success since it opened in October 2023. Located in a stone cottage on Montezuma Street in Prescott, Bear and Dragon takes its name from the nicknames of Adam's two kids, Bridget, Little Bear, and Drake, the Dragon. But the name also reflects a British pub tradition dating to the days before widespread literacy, when pubs used pictures to depict their names. Inside, Adam and her husband Chris replicated the feel of an English cottage with wall sconces, floor-to-ceiling books, and framed portraits of British literary figures. Adam fell in love with British culture on her first of many visits to England, and later, serving and bartending in Los Angeles gave her restaurant experience. She returned to Prescott after her children were born, and when she was ready to go back to work, she started Bear and Dragon as a food truck serving specialty coffees, salads, and press sandwiches. Those items became the foundation of the current restaurant's lunch menu. The prologue section offers coffee lattes, such as the Jane Austen with rose and lavender, and tea lattes, such as the Charles Dickens with PG Tips Tea, Earl Grey Simple Syrup, and Milk Over Ice. Chapter 1 features breakfast entrees such as the Tolkien's, eggs, sausages, mushrooms, sautéed tomato, English rasher bacon, and beans, and the Queen Victoria, a pot of tea served with British scones, house-made clotted cream, cherry jam, and lemon curd. Chapter 2 includes lunch entrees such as a Merlin salad with arugula, mixed greens, tomato, bacon, chopped mozzarella, and basil pesto dressing. There are pressed sandwiches, too, such as the Sir Lancelot, prime rib, Havarti, pickled onion, and herbed horseradish cream. Adam designed the dinner menu, served Thursday through Saturday, to read like elevated cottage food, with entrees that include bangers and mash and cottage pie. An inventive cocktail menu features the War and Peace, peach and orange blossom vodka, fresh lime and mint, floated with ginger beer, and the London Smog, gin, vanilla liqueur, milk, Earl Grey tea, and lemon, served in a teacup over ice. As the story went to press, Adam was planning to roll out high tea on Sundays, and she's a purist. You have to have the sugar cubes and all the little things, she says. With amazing teas, scones, sandwiches, and house-made pétophores and tarts, it's going to be fun. Bear and Dragon Cafe is located at 334 South Montezuma Street in Prescott. Phone number 928-445-4333. Website beardragon.cafe. And this concludes Bear and Dragon Cafe. Suzanne Wright is the author of Tahana Chul. In addition to its beautiful gardens, this 49-acre urban oasis offers visitors a lesson in the importance of community, understanding climate change, and celebrating the heritage of the Sonoran Desert. It's easy to miss the modest entrance to Tohono O'odham, which is tucked into the Casas Adobes community on the north side of Tucson. But for four decades, the park, whose name is a Tohono O'odham phrase that translates to desert corner, has been teaching visitors about the beauty and fragility of desert life. Tohono O'odham has been a part of Tohono's lives and a treasure in the state of Arizona since 1985, says Jamie Maslin Larson, the park's executive director. Besides the beauty of our gardens, we have an origin story that is relevant to contemporary issues around community, climate change, and celebrating the Sonora Desert's heritage. That origin story began in 1966 when benefactors Richard and Jean Wilson began piecing together patches of the desert that would form the park's initial 37 acres. In 1968, they purchased a section containing the hacienda-style West House, now the park's Garden Bistro, where they lived for 8 years. As the area which abuts Oro Valley began to boom, the couple was approached several times by developers but refused to cash out, instead seeking to preserve it. And when saguaro cactuses were displaced by Pima County's widening of Ina Road, the Wilsons had them replanted on their adjacent property. The park opened in 1985, and later additions brought Tohono O'odham to its current size of 49 acres, and as commercial development has gobbled up the suburban landscape, the Wilsons' foresight has taken on new value. As visitors walk the braided trails deeper into Tohono O'odham, the thrum of traffic falls away and the park's rural character emerges. "We're creating a mosaic experience," Maslin Larson says. "We want to be representative of all things in the Sonoran Desert." The park is located in an affluent, retiree-heavy area, but in recent years, an effort at more diverse programming has attracted visitors from all over town. The Children's Museum Oro Valley, located on park grounds, offers nature-based activities aimed at fostering appreciation for the Sonoran Desert, and it also hosts school trips and a summer STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math camp. "We play a huge role in closing the nature deficit gap by letting kids be wild explorers of our gardens," Maslin Larson says. For visitors of all ages, there are events such as Chillin' at the Chul, a summer after-hours series that gives visitors a chance to experience the garden in cooler nighttime temperatures. Live music and refreshments add to the ambiance, and seating areas under shady acacias, mesquites, and palms encourage folks to linger. Annual events such as the Chili's Chocolate and Day of the Dead Festival in autumn and holiday nights in December draw crowds, but the garden manages to maintain a serene vibe. Perhaps the best-known event, the Summer Bloom Night, is an opportunity to walk illuminated trails and breathe in the enchanting perfume of the night-blooming cirrus, Peniocerus gregii, a cactus that blooms just one night per year. For weeks ahead of the spectacle, the park staff closely monitors the impending bloom. Tohono O'odham's art galleries host revolving exhibitions, and the park also is home to dance performances, lectures, movie nights, plant sales, workshops, and yoga classes. Three well-curated gift shops are stocked with unique artwork, books, and souvenirs, and the bodega boasts cactus chips, jams, paletas, and more. Brunch at the Garden Bistro features specialties such as huevos rancheros and mesquite flour pancakes. But the heart of Tohono O'odham is in its more than 200 volunteers and docents. Janelle Firabend is in her 10th year as a volunteer after moving to Tucson and discovering the park in my backyard. Some weeks, she's there every day. "Our goal is to have our guests feel a sense of place in the bliss of Tohono O'odham," she says. "We don't work off a script. We read the people we're interacting with and what they're interested in. Those interests might spur the staff to invite visitors to cup and breathe on tiny creosote leaves to release their distinctive petrichor, or to listen to the tapping of a nearby Gila woodpecker, or to spot a shiny kingsnake or identify a skittering zebra-tailed lizard. Familiarity with the unique traits of our desert, plants, and animals helps all of us to appreciate the need to preserve the health of our deserts and our one-of-a-kind planet," Firabend says. We like to think that the guests return home filled with renewed inspiration to practice quality stewardship no matter what part of the world they inhabit. The approach is working. Maslin Larson says before the pandemic, annual visitation topped out at 52,000. In 2023, the park welcomed 92,000 visitors. The Wilsons had a vision, she says. They saw the direction of growth then, and today, two generations later, we enjoy it, and it will be here for the next generations as well. Tahana Chul is located at 7366 North Paseo del Norte, phone number 520-742-6455, website tahanachul.org. And this concludes Tahana Chul. Matt Jaffe is the author of This Land Is My Land. In 1913, William Randolph Hearst bought a piece of land with one of the most beautiful views in the world. He was planning on building a dream house there, or maybe a hotel, or maybe nothing at all. No one knows for sure, because Stephen Mather, the director of the National Park Service, thought that Grandview Point belonged to all Americans. William Randolph Hearst was a man accustomed to getting his way. Heir to a mining and ranching fortune worth hundreds of millions in today's dollars, he was a media mogul, art collector, and two-term member of Congress. He ran for president in 1904, finishing second for the Democratic Party nomination. Rich and powerful, Hearst stood 6'3" and was anything but shy about throwing his weight around. He clashed with both Theodore and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and played kingmaker, and his exploits inspired Citizen Kane, considered by many the greatest film ever made. Biographer David Nassau wrote that for decades, Hearst ruled his empire as autocratically as his heroes, Julius Caesar and Napoleon Bonaparte, had theirs. He had trusted no one and rejected suggestions that he share power or delegate decision-making. In other words, there was a reason many in Hearst's time called him the chief. The National Park Service's first director, Stephen Tyne Mather, had a few things in common with Hearst. The scion of a prominent Puritan family that came to America in 1635, Mather also was born in San Francisco and stood over 6 feet tall. For a time, he worked as a reporter at the New York Sun, the rival to Hearst's own newspapers in America's largest city. But while Hearst's fortunes came from silver mining, borax made Mather a millionaire, and he's credited with creating the famous 20 Mule Team brand. Mather achieved his success even while battling bipolar disorder, which spiraled him into the darkest of places. As Horace M. Albright, who succeeded Mather as Park Service Director, observed, his energy and exuberance, which accomplished so many great things, could turn to deep, silent, suicidal depression with little warning. If the Arizona ties of these men seem limited, Hearst and Mather face off at a site worthy of their stature, the Grand Canyon 7,400-foot Grandview Point. Hearst purchased the property in 1913, and a subsequent struggle for one of the South Rim's loftiest promontories played out for more than 20 years and at the highest levels of American power and influence. Hearst, for his part, knew what he had at Grandview. I think it is the best on the canyon. Which brings us to canyon legend Pete Berry. His grave marker in the Grand Canyon Pioneer Cemetery states the basics. P. D. Berry, born May 1856, died September 1932. A whole lot happened in between. A Colorado miner, Berry came to Arizona seeking vengeance after the murder of his brother John, proprietor of Flagstaff San Juan Sample and Club Room, a saloon touting gambling tables that never closed. John was shot and killed during a brawl between two local ruffians and other saloon patrons. In a bit of frontier-style karma, vigilantes broke into the jail where the ruffians were taken, then killed the pair. Upon arriving in Flagstaff, Berry supposedly declared, "Boys, you saved me the job." But that bluster doesn't square with canyon photographer Emery Kolb's recollections of Berry. In a handwritten 1973 letter, Kolb, who apologized, "As I am now 93 years old and forget a lot," characterized Berry as a hard-working and honest man, a recovering alcoholic with good carpentry skills and a slow manner of speaking. When starting to tell a little story, it always took him half an hour or more to get it out, Kolb wrote. Settling in Arizona, Barry soon married his murdered brother's beautiful widow, May, then sought mining opportunities at the canyon. He partnered with businessman and future U.S. Senator Ralph Cameron and his brother Niles, and they would go on to literally leave their mark on the Grand Canyon. Barry and the Camerons expanded an old indigenous path from the rim to Indian Garden, now Havasupai Gardens, and opened the Bright Angel Toll Road, today's Bright Angel Trail. And in 1892, Barry started constructing the Grandview Trail to boost production from the Last Chance Mine, the canyon's most significant copper vein. Each day, as many as 10 mules would each haul 200 pounds of high-grade ore, 4 trail miles, and 2,500 vertical feet from Horseshoe Mesa to Grandview Point. The mine proved more productive than profitable, and it also cost Barry his marriage. A fan of neither the canyon life nor Barry's frequent absences, May ran off to Tucson with the traveling salesman. By some accounts, she took their son Ralph, named after Cameron, with her, and Barry then paid $100 to one of the Camerons to kidnap Ralph and bring him back. Barry remarried and opened the Grandview Hotel, the canyon's first major lodging facility. The only first-class hotel at the Grand Canyon of the Colorado River in Arizona declared a rate card advertising nightly stays for $2. Guests arrived by stagecoach from Flagstaff to a hotel built of ponderosa pine, and although hardly opulent, the Grandview had its appeal. In a 1976 history, park ranger Sonia Sandberg cites a Yelp-worthy review. One of Europe's many counts described his stay at the Grandview as restful, charming, rustic, good food. The hotel prospered until the Santa Fe Railroad began running from Williams to Grand Canyon Village in 1901. Barry tried to hold on, shuttling guests 11 miles by stagecoach from the depot, but he couldn't compete with the convenience of the village's Fred Harvey accommodations. According to Sandberg, Barry suffered a major setback when the U.S. Forest Service, which administered what then was the Grand Canyon Forest Reserve, took away access to a water source on reserve land, a move apparently in deference to Santa Fe and Fred Harvey interests. In 1913, Barry sold the hotel and its land for $26,000 and another 160 acres of property for $49,000 to a guy named Hearst. Barry's anger was typical, if a bit more extreme than most. A 2000 Administrative History of Grand Canyon National Park concludes, he refused time and time again to succumb to railroad purchase offers, choosing instead to sell to William Randolph Hearst, who he believed, correctly, would prove a thorn in the government's side. Hearst was no stranger to Arizona. His father, George, had owned the San Pedro River Valley's Boquilas land grant, and Hearst inherited that holding before selling it in 1901. And while trying to drum up support for his 1904 presidential bid, he traveled through Arizona by private rail car during a 12-day whistle-stop tour, officially named the Congressional Trip by Special Train through the Southwestern Territories in the interest of statehood. More poetically described by the Arizona Republican as a comet-like journey through the territory or mountain, valley, and plain, the 1903 tour stopped at the canyon. It featured U.S. senators, 17 members of Congress, and marching bands, with Hearst newspaper reporters and photographers covering the extravaganza. Statehood advocates deified Hearst. Tucson's Arizona Daily Star wrote, "This modern Hercules of the press with his associates will battle on to crystallize the facts into a law creating Arizona into a sovereign commonwealth. This will surely come to pass. Let us be grateful." Hearst's Grandview purchase came a year after Arizona statehood, and some assumed he'd establish residency, then run for U.S. Senate. Anything was possible considering Hearst's serial candidate history, which had included campaigns for New York governor and New York city mayor. But Hearst was also an inveterate builder. Flagstaff's Coconino Sun concluded that the site's wonderful setting would naturally convince the casual observer that the project is more than one of securing a home on the brink of the canyon. The Hearst-owned Los Angeles Herald Examiner described Hearst's intentions to build a lodge and a private residence at Grandview, while others gossiped that he bought the place for a $1 million bungalow. In a 1926 note to architect Julia Morgan, his collaborator on California's Hearst Castle, Hearst mused about a Hopi-style house at Grandview. He thought it would better fit the setting than a stone structure, but worried, "It is just a mud house. Perhaps we could mix the mud with something that would keep it from disintegrating into dirt," he added with rambling glee. "There is a certain attractiveness to the Hopi style of architecture. Of course, it would be as full of atmosphere as a poison pup. We could have Indian paintings on the wall and Indian rugs on the floor and Indian fleas all over us. I can hardly wait until the house is done. It is going to be romantic and itchy." Hearst's acquisition came just a few years before the establishment of the Park Service and Mather's appointment as its director. Summarizing his philosophy, Mather declared, "The Yosemite, the Yellowstone, the Grand Canyon are national properties in which every citizen has a vested interest. They belong as much to the man of Massachusetts, of Michigan, of Florida, as they do to the people of California, of Wyoming, and of Arizona." The decades-long campaign to designate Grand Canyon National Park was also nearing completion despite considerable local opposition, including that of the powerful Ralph Cameron. Hearst also had concerns, and Albright suggested he wielded his influence behind the scenes to block the designation. Albright concluded Hearst was afraid the National Park Service would take Grandview and that Berry property away from him. That's why he didn't want it made a park. Mather was philosophically opposed to private inholdings and coveted Grandview, especially because Hearst remained cagey about his plans. A years-long stalemate ensued as Hearst sought a land exchange and Mather proposed that Hearst never develop the land commercially, then donate the property upon his death. They did find some common ground. During planning for construction of Desert View Drive, a deal allowed the park to build its preferred route across Hearst's lands. Then something remarkable happened. After years of sporadic indirect communication, Mather, Albright, and Hearst met in San Francisco. Albright recalled, "Hearst was just as gentle as a baby, kindly eyes and friendly smile, and charming and pleasant." Hearst told the park officials his only desire was to build a museum for his Indian artifact collections. But a 1936 Morgan design shows a Mission Revival-style hotel that would have been the canyon's grandest structure, with twin bell towers, balconies overlooking the canyon, and alcoves for Santos along the entryway. Mather's health problems led to his resignation in 1929, and he died the following year. Under Albright's leadership, the Park Service continued to target Grandview. The ongoing dispute played out amid Hearst's growing financial troubles and the Roosevelt administration's concern about what officials characterized as the erratic and unscrupulous moguls' degrading influence on the American people and potential impact on the 1936 presidential race. In 1939, as the Park Service sought the land through condemnation proceedings, Hearst still refused to sell. Arizona U.S. Senator Carl Hayden called Interior Secretary Harold L. Ickes and argued that Hearst had been assured long ago that the property would never be taken against his wishes. Ickes held firm, telling Hayden the park really ought to have this land, which Hearst has never used, and that the thing to do was to agree to a fair price. Hayden responded, "Hearst hates to give up any property that he owns." That September, the condemnation suit was finally filed to acquire 207.7 acres of Hearst Canyon properties for $28,950. While there were legitimate local concerns about private property rights and the loss of tax revenue, the rhetoric veered to extremes. The stink on the brink was among the milder characterizations. The Williams newspapers called the action imperialistic, adding that the move may have been stimulated by the aggressions of dictators of Europe, before likening the Park Service to Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. Others worked in references to Nazis and fascists for good measure. The bottom line, Hearst demanded $392,100 for his properties, but a federal judge awarded him $85,000. Grandview Point officially became part of the park in 1941. Today, Mather Point immortalizes Mather, while the park's Horace M. Albright Training Center honors his successor. You can also still hike the Grandview Trail built by Berry, who remains a fixture in canyon lore. He moved to a nearby ranch, still dreaming of the big score that had always eluded him. Years earlier, Berry had known a gang of horse thieves, one of whom was mortally wounded in a shootout with law enforcement. The dying man told Berry he had buried a copper kettle filled with gold on the Tanner Trail. Terry never forgot, and as an old man, planned to head down into the canyon one last time to recover the treasure. He never made the trek. Meanwhile, Barry's Grandview Hotel enjoys a glorious afterlife. After the hotel's demolition, Hearst salvaged the building's ponderosa pine logs, which were repurposed for Desert View Watchtower's indigenous-inspired lobby ceiling. Hearst never did build his Hopi dream house at Grandview, but somewhere he might be enjoying a satisfied laugh while Mather curses the fates, because deep within the canyon, along the north side of the Colorado River, there's an old asbestos mine. A family inherited the land from a prominent ancestor who acquired it decades ago. That land is the Hearst Tract, the only private inholding within Grand Canyon National Park's original boundaries. And this concludes This Land Is My Land. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left click on broadcast info and audio, then under programming links, left click on demand podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.